So very good day to all of you listeners out there. Welcome to another episode of Simon Says. We have Lyra here today.
Hello.
And Lyra, we're just doing an episode on the American system, right? And we're like, nothing much is happening. But then this week, a lot of things have been happening.
Yes.
And of course, one of the biggest news, I was in Singapore when I saw the news and people were just messaging me and say, you know, what do you think about, you know, Deputy Prime Minister Zahid getting, you know, DNAA, you know, discharge not amounting to acquittal. And, you know, when, I did practice a little bit of criminal law, just for a tiny portion. So at least I know what that means, you know. And, but I have to tell you, this is something that is very, very common in our criminal system.
Would you say that it's a term that is most commonly misinterpreted?
Yeah, I guess so, because, from the beginning, you realize, you know, some parties are trying to blame the judge. And they say, oh, you know, the judge agreed to that. But the thing is, you know, if we look at what it means, right, discharge not amounting to acquittal, that means it's like the prosecutor is doing certain things, they're withdrawing the whole charge, maybe because of lack of evidence, maybe they need more investigation. In fact, that was one of the reasons. They say somebody lodged an MSCC report against the judge, bias and things like that. Not against the judge, against Tommy Thomas. And things like that. So we needed more time. And of course, whether you can sell that politically to the people of Malaysia is another question. But just to make it plain and clear, DNAA is an initiation by the prosecutor and no one else. The judge has no choice but to accept that. And that is different from another high-profile case also, Boo Mokhtar. And he got DAA. Discharge amount to acquittal, and that's different because the judge basically say not enough evidence. Evidence is not good. That one, you can put it solely on the responsibility of the judge. So, I mean, what interesting timing, right? And people sort of have a lot of conspiracy theory, you know, who is arranging it. I don't think it's related because Boo Mokhtar's case has been around for 5 years, whereas Zahid's case, much less than that. So, Solara, did you feel a lot of anger maybe in some of the media that we have been reading?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, of course, the high profile ones, the one politician that I personally like to talk about is Syed Saddiq. So he is very much triggered, I think, by the whole situation.
And we're just talking during dinner time, right? That, you know, look at the exchange between him and Nga Kormen. And I went back to see what Nga said. In fact, Nga said something very, very benign, you know, just say, look, if you want to withdraw from the unity government, you can do it properly. And all of a sudden, Nga become the lapdog of UMNO. So, yeah, I mean, I like what you say, trigger. He seems personally triggered by the whole thing.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, because coming from, he's someone who really advocate for, I think, like, meritocracy.
Mm-hmm.
So he is someone who I think perhaps understand the whole action of the affirmative action that we have been talking so much. Mm-hmm. And yet it felt like he's the one that is needing the affirmation itself.
Mm.
I felt like that's the whole sentiment that I get from this whole triggering emotion that he exhibited on his social media.
Now, I know we're not supposed to talk about Muda today, but because... I mean, since you talk about it, let's just discuss it for a while. Because their performance has been sorely lacking, right? And do you think YB Saddiq is trying to find maybe a portion where Muda can really express itself?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think they really want to bring to that picture that they are a voice for the people, that they actually represent the majority
of
Malaysians.
A clean voice?
Yeah,
maybe?
I think so. Because yeah, that's what he's advocating, because he said, look, what we are here for is we want a clean government.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, later on we'll see that even the Prime Minister himself said that this is a system that we have inherited over a few decades. So it's not so easy as just come in and just do a clean slate. I mean, I work in a construction industry. If you have a house that is being renovated for, let's say, the past 60 years, that's absurd. But the thing is, maybe the original design has been completely so much change that you just have to keep on re-digging the SBL just to find out, oh, if this section is done correctly or not. So I felt like it's a bit demanding of him.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we understand that there has to be a need to go through that reformation, but it felt like he perhaps put the expectation a little bit too high on the unity government.
Yeah. And I think what you sum up about YB Shite really is also my feeling on a lot of the responses. In fact, I was just reading and just so much anger from civil rights society, from different portion of politicians and things like that. So I think today we don't really want to go into the whole argument, you know, who is at fault and things like that, because it will be endless. But instead, we want to look at maybe 4 to 5 broader questions. And I like what you mentioned early on, because one of the article I think just published like maybe today by Prime Minister himself, right? He was giving a comment and he kind of referred back to the system. There is a systemic thing. And we have talked about the deep state. We have talked about there is just the unseen hand that is controlling the whole narrative. But we're going to ask a few questions, you know, from the more specific one, and then we kind of go, kind of broader and broader, and hopefully, you know, we give our perspective, I guess, on the whole incident. All right, so the first one, and it's a direct question to the incident, right? And this goes back to December last year. That was after all the discussions, then finally the news, we have a new unity government, right? So when the unity government was formed, and then not only formed, right, Zahid Hamidi was appointed deputy prime minister. So immediately at that time, you know, and even now, do you expect the corruption case against him to fail? So I kind of put it in a semi-positive manner, because I you know, it's really when you are being charged, no matter who you are, and that's one of the things I always bear in mind, is that it's easy for us to say, yes, he is corrupted, yes, Najib is corrupted, but when someone is charged, they should be given the opportunity to reply. But when that happened, do you expect, I mean, what was your feeling and thinking at that time? Do you expect maybe the case against him might be weakened or crumble?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I personally think it's not something that is a bit unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Not unexpected. So you were not quite surprised?
No, not okay. At all. I mean, not that I'm, but I don't think, it's like I felt like I was quite neutral about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I agree that the case is being, I mean, going towards this direction or the other direction for that matter, but I felt like there should be a principle in Malaysia that is being upheld, the rule of law,
mm-hmm.
whereby everyone is innocent until proven guilty.
Yep.
So in this case, we should give him the benefit of doubt. I mean, in this case, there is a lack of evidence, I mean, as claimed by the prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to take their word for it. I mean, obviously, these are the professionals that are dealing with all these cases. And I myself, a commoner, not really understanding the law so much. I felt like if I were in that position, I mean, I would want to have be given a fair chance to really just present my case and be really judged accordingly. So I felt like in the same case, we should give him the benefit of doubt, because there has been so much coverage by the media, because for all we know, I mean, which case is real, which case is fake? We don't know, you know, because after all that has been happening over the last few years, especially the media has been supposedly to be the fourth estate, yet they have been really just going along the propaganda of the government of the day. So I felt like we should really take a step back from this whole thing and really just begin to examine it from another perspective. I mean, give the person the due process. Mm. So, and like what we mentioned earlier on, it's DNAA. It's not amounting to acquittal. So what's the big deal about this whole thing?
Yeah, I guess just reading all the reports and things like that, the emotion concerning the decision was really, on one hand, yes, I totally agree with you that everyone deserves the due process. I mean, look at ex-Prime Minister Najib. He kind of exhausted all the due process. And you can say he has been given far and beyond what an ordinary person will get in Malaysia. So I would say he has a very fair due process. For Zahid Hamidi, I think what people are kind of clamoring and not quite happy was that they felt like the due process was skipped. Now, of course, you know, a lot of people don't realize that when you have evidence, when someone gives a testimony, even when you have a documents, every time the judge make a decision. Yes, it should be based on law, but a lot of time it is opinion. It is their legal opinion, and they'll say, oh, I admit the evidence or I don't admit the evidence. So it's the same thing for the prosecutor. I decide to charge or I don't charge. And I guess there is that, and we're going to go back to what Prime Minister himself said, right? And the feeling was that the prosecutor, the DPP, you are answerable to Attorney General. And Attorney General, you are answerable to Prime Minister. But how would you reply to this kind of, you know, I think a lot of people just felt like Prime Minister is supposed to be able to control the prosecution, but is that even his job?
No, I don't think so. I think it is like what he said, that it's going to be equivalent to an abuse of power.
Mm.
Because we have been talking so much and we have been advocating for decentralization, and I felt like this is really towards the right direction for the country.
Mm.
Because surely people don't want another prime minister that is like Tun Mahathir, that controls everything, the yep. finance department, everything else. So I felt like that is something that I would expect from the prime minister himself.
Mm.
So that I felt like it's a good direction.
In terms of let all the different parts of the government run by itself, and then hopefully we don't have this centralized one man show power kind of thing.
Because recently, I mean, I just read about the term that calls administrative terrorism.
Mm-hmm, okay.
I felt like it's really real in Malaysia as well. Mm. I mean, talking about deep state, we have been talking so much about deep state, but what exactly is deep state?
Mm.
I mean, another term to describe it would be administrative state, whereby you really have this whole group of people that are running the administrative works for the country.
Yep.
And it's a large population. You're not talking about just 100K people. It's a huge task force behind him. Are we expecting the CEO, let's say a CEO of the company, to really go down to every manufacturing branch to really just look at how are you doing, how are you running your production and things like that? I think it's illogical to think about it. So if we think it's illogical for a CEO of the company, let's say like Elon Musk, to go to every single manufacturing plant to just look at the production. I mean, yes, he's very hands-on. But the thing is that the job of a CEO? The job of the CEO is to really just expand the business and really cast the vision for the company. So in the same way, I felt like that's the role of the Prime Minister as well, that he's there to set the course for the whole country. His job is not to manually just go behind you and breathe down your neck and just see, are you doing your work or not?
What they say, Elon Musk kind of slept in a factory, right, for 3 years. But anyway, you know, do you feel maybe there's a bit of the Asian and Confucius mindset, you know, like, I mean, these days, I mean, if there's a defect in Toyota, Mazda, you don't see the chairman or CEO even step down today. But 20 years ago, maybe. You know, it's like the corporate version of committing suicide, right?
Yeah, I mean, like Disney is doing so poorly, but are we expecting Disney CEOs to step down? No.
Yeah. So I'm just looking at the emotion, the outpouring of emotion. Is it because people expect, hey, you are the leader, you should take responsibility? But Prime Minister is like, it's not my responsibility. And I think he has been quite consistent in that. Ever since he formed the unity government, he has been kind of, people kind of come to him with this kind of question. Like, what about Zahid? What about Zahid? A few times already. And he just said, look, I'm going to let the law take its course. I mean, if anything, I think Anwar has been extremely consistent in this area. And so, but I think this is a good time for us to ask a second question, okay? Which is, what are some of the constraints faced by the unity government? Now, of course, not specifically related to Zahid Hamidi's case, but I think it will give the picture of what's happening here and kind of give us a bit of insight into what you've been saying, right? The deep state, administrative terrorism, you know, all the different things. Maybe you'd like to kind of briefly just explain to our viewers and listeners, you know, what exactly is deep state or administrative state, you know, whatever term. I mean, I know there are some technical differences, but just for the sake of discussion, we kind of lump them together.
Well, I think in a very generic term, it would be like the civil service.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would be like the best way to describe them. Are we saying that all of them are bad apple?
No, of course not.
I mean, but these are the crucial task force that are really well, helping the country run its course. Mm. But the thing is, there have been infiltration, obviously, by certain propaganda, certain, really just certain people having their own agenda. Mm. Like you have GLC as well. I mean, these are also a branch of like deep state. I would consider them as deep state as well, because you're on one hand, you're talking about we need to help the Felda, the settlers. But on the other hand, you have the group itself, Felda, that is really controlling the profit and maybe not really helping them, because although that's the role of their job to really help this group of people to come to really a settlement and really flourishing, but because of their own agenda that has really gone in the case. So I think that is an example of deep state.
Now, would you say the security apparatus, like police, special branch, military, are they part of deep state?
Oh, for sure. I mean, obviously, they listen to a boss.
What about the monarchy?
I think so. I mean,
you know, when we say monarchy, we are not kind of like disparaging them, but we are saying in the sense of their collective power, their influence, their prestige, because it has control and influence over especially culture and religion. So we cannot underestimate. So I think another definition of deep state is really people who doesn't need to be accountable. You know, politician needs to be accountable. Every 5 years, they will face the music. And in fact, they can face the music even in parliament. There could be disciplines. The government could change and things like that. As minister, they could be fired and things like that. But I mean, all the things we mentioned, civil service, security apparatus, monarchy even, GLC, all these do not need to be accountable to the rakyat per se.
Yeah, I mean, just using US for an example, I mean, you really have people, I mean, certain three-letter branch, like FBI, CIA, they don't really need to be accountable. I mean, even you see like Department of Justice that is just running rampant.
Yep.
So these are really an example of the deep state, that they are really not accountable in a way.
So Prime Minister seems to blame the deep state in his latest article. Do you feel so?
I think so.
And now it's interesting that, you know, I was just looking at one article by Murray Hunter. Now, Murray Hunter, of course, have wrote many articles critical of the government. But one of the latest ones, just a few days ago, he wrote it in Sinchu. I didn't even know Sinchu has an English branch, okay? And the title is Getting to Know the Mandali Government. By Their Deeds, You Will Know Them. Now, he went on and list, I mean, not like super long list, but just some of the very bad things done by the government. And I think I kind of agree. But very interestingly, Murray also wrote a very short book on deep state. And so here is, I find a bit of contradiction in him, because on one hand, he's saying, look, there is the deep state that is really hampering Prime Minister. But now on the other hand, he is like kind of hantaming the Madani. But of course, just some of the things he mentions, which unfortunately I do agree. You know, he say, look, there is lack of progress, general progress. He said no reforms in education and health. And I think we can't deny that. Really, in fact, he made a very good point about health. And he said, look, why are we still following WHO, COVID focus? We should be moving on from COVID already. And look at, you know, now we have malaria, we have dengue. We have to look at what's happening here. Then, of course, he mentioned about draconian laws like SOSMA. And that's why when you look at Interior Minister, right, it's like Saifuddin, it's like, What is he talking about? You know, some of the PKR ministers are really, you know, getting on the nerve of some people, because it's like they are not doing what Pakatan Harapan said they were doing. But then we go back to another point. Is it even fair to expect the policies of Pakatan Harapan when this is not a Pakatan Harapan government?
I mean, it's not fair at all. Mm. I mean, we have to quote from KJ and Shari Handan. First episode, they already say, look, the first day that unity government is formed, the whole manifesto from Pakatan Harapan has to be thrown out of the window. That's just as simple as it is, because everyone has to come to the table. Everyone brings their portion to the table, discuss, talk it through. And obviously, the Prime Minister's hands are really, really tight.
Mm. And of course, one of the things Now, remember we did an episode on Manifesto, right? And we're just having a bit laugh because Barisan National Manifesto looked really, really weak, okay? And Perikatan National, of course, at that time, not a lot of federal manifesto because I think they didn't even expect to do so well. But the new unity government, I think on purpose, they are not laying out any manifesto because I guess you can say maybe the points of agreement are very narrow between PH and Barisan National.
I think so.
And I mean, you look at the state elections, even the by-election in Johor now, you can see there's a bit of... It's a very forced kind of relationship. You know, in Chinese, we say it's very mian qiang. And you see that really in the state election also. So I guess their style is like hear no evil, see no evil. If we don't have anything better to say, just don't say anything at all. And that seems to be the way. But do you think it's good? Or do you think we should just say, look, this unity government, if we want it to be for the next 4 years, this is not Pakatan Harapan government, just don't expect the reform. You know, if Prime Minister come out and say something like that, I think he's an honest statement, but do you think it will work?
Maybe not. I mean, we definitely still hope for some form of reformation because he advocates, I mean, he of all people, he advocates for reformation. I think surely with his witty skills, he'll be able to bring some to the table. I mean, maybe not the full reformation that we hope to see, but at least certain progress that will secure another victory for him in the next general election. Because if you don't have any KPI at all, why would people want to still vote for you? Because yes, there is no viable alternative for now, but that doesn't mean that in years to come, there might be someone else. So if you want to remain relevant, you really have to do something that really shows the result. I think at the end of the day, people are just looking at the results. Why do the black communities support President Trump so much? I mean, especially even after the mugshot that has been released, that they felt like it's like, well, Trump for 2024 or Trump for life, Trump for king. I mean, there's just some sort of like, really, they really begin to see the deep state that is running in the United States. And that, I think, they really see that, well, this person really has a heart for the country. And I think that is the thing that we really want to see from our Prime Minister, that he has a heart for the country. And he's, I mean, yes, we know that his hands are tied, but that shouldn't be the sole excuse of not performing.
Yeah, I'm just hoping that the Prime Minister, through all the things that has been happening, and especially the last state election, that he will be able to recognize that there is a populist movement. And when we say populist movement, it is not defined, it is not limited to a particular point of view. So it's not like, oh, the conservative in Malaysia, you know, the cultural, religious conservative, or it is not talking about people who want free economy. But really, you know, when you look around the world, the rise of populism is really all over the place. And I just saw a very apt kind of comparison. You know, it's not about conservative, it's not about free market, it's not about all this value, but it's really about populace versus the elite. And I think this is something that I hope Prime Minister will be able to see, because why people are unhappy, why people felt economically oppressed, and you know why, you know, when Mahathir was doing all the damages in the late 80s and 90s, you don't see this kind of pushback, because life is good. I mean, that's the reality of economy. Malaysia was one of the rising dragon. So I think this is the right time for us to move to the next question. Is Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim still the person? That's your question, actually. So I'll let you answer.
Answering my own question.
Yeah.
Well, I think for now, I personally do think that he's still the one. Mm-hmm. I mean, he proved himself when he actually was able to form the coalition. I mean, no one else does it. I mean, obviously, we don't prefer certain parties, but he did it very, very gracefully. And I felt like the separation, I mean, even just the cabinet members, how he disseminated it, I felt like that's quite of his style. I mean, he plays his card well.
Yep.
So I think for now, during this transition, I felt like he's still the one.
Lara, I do agree with you, because I mean, just look at who else. I mean, it's like the voters, we forget that we decided that nobody has majority. So this is the fault of the voters, okay? So that's the first thing to remember. And out of the result of the last general election, he was the one managed to put a coalition. And we already said many, many times that everyone knew compromises are to be made. But of course, whenever it happens... Now, by the way, of course, most of our audience here, listeners, are more Pakatan Harapan leaning voters, right? I mean, is it fair to say that?
Yeah, I think so.
And so people like us get vexed with things like what the Zahid and things like that. But people don't realize that the same thing are also vexing Barisan Nasional supporter. You know, it's like you're pushing for this. This is not our value. We don't want this. We still want the GLC and things like that. We don't care for your ESG or whatever kind of thing. So there is some kind of conflict out there. And for me, the thing is really, I mean, we mentioned earlier on already, we cannot think that we are Barisan Nasional governments or we are the Pakatan Harapan government, but it's a kind of compromise reality. And we have to, one of the arguments, of course, is 9 months already and the result seems a bit lacking. But nevertheless, I agree with you that I believe he's still, out of all the potential candidate, he's still the most suitable one.
But honestly, out of all the reformation, one thing that I really, really hope to see is to bring back local elections. I think that will really, really, really just deliver the results, you know? Because that is the really a true form of decentralization that he has been talking about. Because he has been gracious to have even a Sarawakian DPM. So that shows that it is possible to have Sabahan and Sarawakian DPM and maybe even other states DPM as well, or even Prime Minister as a candidate next time. So I really want to see more decentralization. And I felt like he could be the one that is still bringing this through.
Yeah, I think whenever I look at what's happening in this cycle, you know, I think about the word transition, and transition is never easy. And you see, one of the big transitions after World War II is Japan, for example. And Japan has to transition. Yes, you can say they were forced to do it. American military was there. But, you know, as a society, the Japanese basically bite the bullet and say, okay, we have been defeated. We're going alone. And a reformation they did have. And yeah, within one or two generations, they are a totally different country. But I think leading to the last questions, and before I mention the last question, I want to just kind of mention the link, you know, and going back to all the hoo-ha, the emotional outpouring, all the vexing, anger, publishing, whatever, you know. And I think the root of all this emotion is really people think the government are magician. That they can solve everything. So it's like people put too much hope in government. And I think this is a big problem in Malaysia. We have been so used to... And you just go back to a few years ago, COVID time, when government could not help people in general. And the response is, oh, this government is very bad. And that's why we have two or three change of government during the COVID cycle. It's because people just... You know, we are in this cycle. That's why the fourth question is this, and the last question. Are we placing too much hope on the government? You know, and this hope really kind of manifests into big government thinking. Big government basically is like, every time there is a problem, the government must come and help me. So you have a bit of that in China, in Singapore, but you see the limitation of big government is whenever the government doesn't have enough to help you or the leadership are corrupt, then the big government will become a terror big government. But what do you think of this?
Well, I think that we are, first of all, a group of people that are really very much still embracing the welfare mentality. Because we have been so used to it. I mean, because generally we have like a lot of B40 and M40s. But really, I mean, if you look at the definition, even we saw from Mr. Money that T20, huh? You mean like 10K is also considered T20? So that really shows that actually people still need a lot of help.
Yep.
And they actually enjoy help from the government. Whenever there's handout, they happily go and take it. So that shows that the whole society as a as a whole, I think they have not really matured to a state that they are able to handle a lot of problems themselves. I think it goes back to them not taking accountability of their own issues. And not to say that, I mean, obviously we recognize that there's systemic corruption, systemic poverty, but really, I mean, even just the spirit of Kita Jaga Kita during the whole pandemic era, people should begin to think that, hey, they are stronger than who they think they are.
Yep.
And they really have the capacity and capability to even really just be able to help the society, help the community. So people should really begin to see that they shouldn't, because otherwise the other extreme will be hope deferred. Because obviously the last cycle that we saw was, oh, the government has failed us when the whole PH collapsed the first time in 22 months.
Going back to Sheraton, right?
Yeah, and people were just so discouraged. The disappointment is really, really real.
But they were in La La Land, you know, unrealistic La La Land.
Yeah, but I felt like that's because either way, they have been placing too much hope on the government, that they are so used to big government that they don't see a lean and nimble way of doing things. And
so they've seen the Pakatang Harapan there, 2018, is a miracle and will kind of reverse all the ills and bad things the last 6 years. I mean, honestly, a lot of people were thinking like that. Yeah, and Lara, I totally agree with you that we have to move on. But remember, even when we talk about the affirmative action 2 episodes, we know that we are in this transition period. We can't just suddenly say, okay, government is not going to help you anymore. So it's going to be progressive, I guess. It's going to, the government will have to introduce things that help people to help themselves. Because at the moment, if you say, okay, that's it, I'm going to remove. Remember when Mahathir made the big hoo-ha in UMNO January, AGM, I think. And he went out and he was like crying and say, oh, the Malay, you know, you cannot continue. I mean, in the end, we know it's just a show, right? The tongkat. But tongkat, I think, is really a good word. It's like, at the moment, you can't just take away the tongkat, right? Would you agree?
Yeah.
I mean, with this kind of economic recession coming out and things like that, income level not up to par, education systemic issue and things like that. So there has to be some kind of transition, but Prime Minister will have to do certain things that help us at least moving towards some sort of self-starting mindset and some sort of participation. So I really like what you say about local election, because you know, I was just discussing with my father today, and you know, he was just saying that a lot of people actually wanted local election. And talk about Cebu, right? We all came from Cebu, and Cebu used to have very strong local government, but it's very strong in the sense that only one party is in charge. So whatever they decide, it'll be done. So very interestingly, recently, the mayor from SUPP wanted to change a road to, you know, to Jalan Robert Lau. And then, very surprisingly, the pushback came from SUPP and the rest of the GPS, because now the local council in Cebu, you have SUPP, you have Tiong Kim Sin Party somehow managed to wrestle La Nan one seat. Then you have PBB in Nangka. So it's like decentralization. So all of a sudden, first time ever, the mayor seems like he's not in charge. But that's decentralization. And I think people kind of feel like, hey, it's good, you know, we have some kind of check and balance. But if people are able to start with local election, just be concerned about whether the rubbish are thrown, the roads are fixed, whether this my junior YB, you know, because I don't know what are they going to call the local. Actually, do they call the councillor YB? Not quite, right?
No, I don't think so.
YB is only for the Adun, right? So I don't know. You have to find a more junior title for them. But now the difference would be they are fully accountable. Now you have all the local councillor, you complain to them, oh, they'll come out and show their face and things like that, but ultimately they are not accountable to you. So I think, would that cause people to be more willing to participate in, I mean, let's not talk about nation building, let's just talk about your own taman building, your own community building?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because recently David and I, we went to really a small kampong in Sarawak that we have not heard of. prior to
you
this.
You have not heard of, okay.
I mean, I have heard of because my grandma came from there. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, they were also just saying, well, each time you see all these facilities are being built, especially when there's a general election, mm-hmm. other time than that, you don't see anything else being developed. So I felt like they really feel the frustration because when else are we going to get all this thing? Because obviously they only come to this small place that people have not heard of once in every 5 years. And that's when they get all the things done. Other than that, you can't expect any more help from the government. So they really become a very, very self-sustaining community. They do their own fishery. They do their own farming. And they are a group of people that really just thrive based on that whole setting. And you really begin to see that, hey, actually, that might work because that's really a form of decentralization, yet the community flourish. But the thing is, obviously, they would need some sort of help from the government as well because especially having the infrastructure built in those places. But imagine if you have local councils that are accountable to this kampong people.
Yep.
They would really come out and vote. And if you're not doing your job, bye-bye.
Yeah, you make certain things may get delayed because people cannot agree. So another incident I just heard is, you know the Pasar Malam in Cebu? It's like behind all the shops, right? So, you know, there was a bit of hoo-ha because there was no toilet there. So every time all the customers were there, if they need to go to the toilet, they will go to the coffee shop nearby. And the coffee shop people were a bit pissed off. So the council decided to put a vote. I think there's only 125 stores, you know, not that many. And they wanted to move the Pasar Malam to the harbour area, the old harbour. Now no more speedboat. And they put a vote. I think 95% say they don't want to move. So that's like a bit of local election expression. Yes, things can get stuck in the past. If government say you move, that's it. No need to discuss. But now, since you want to hear the voices and people start to say no, you get certain things delayed, but ultimately, it is better for our nation, right? To have decentralization.
Yep.
And by the way, when you were both in Cebu, was Argon there already? Has he visited Cebu?
Don't think so.
Okay, I mean, I just suddenly thought about the infrastructure thing because my father just came in and he said the whole road from Cebu town to airport has been fixed for Argon to come.
Oh, I thought it was already fixed.
So it's like, you know, when you go to airport, there was a part basically it's like rock and roll for a while. And it's like smooth. But anyway, this is what my father said. He said, well, it shows you that it can be done very quickly if you want to.
Obviously, if you're the king.
So it's like, why we always have, in Cebu, why we forever we have road issue. Previously, forever we have flood issue. And then all of a sudden, some effort were put in and no more flood issue. So it's like, I think the role of the government, really, you have to fix the infrastructure, but you are not there to give handout to people. So anyway, I mean, we talked a lot of different things already, but just one last point, then we're going to close already. Recently, I was just looking at the state election, and I was a bit surprised, even though it shouldn't surprise me, is, you know, every time we always focus on, you know, the different race, you know, you had the Malay, the Indian vote, the Chinese vote. I've just been paying attention to the Chinese vote because it seems like a huge portion always vote for the opposition or the anti-establishment. And then all of a sudden, even the last state election, you know, 90-plus Chinese voter go for Pakatan. But then, to my surprise, the turnout rate is actually less than 62%. So it's like, imagine this, you still have 35 to 38% potential voters didn't show up. And I mean, I always see this as a positive because that means if you do your job well, you can still convince people. And so, but just one or two points, then we close away. How do you encourage the members of Parti Dida Undi to come out?
Well, it's not easy. I think personally, I was being shifted from that side. True.
But at least you voted the last few rounds already. So yes. that's progress, okay?
Well, I think you kind of just have to really be open. I think have to have that sort of open-mindedness to really just think that your vote matters, you know? Mm-hmm. Because obviously there are certain seats that are really, I mean, it's one way or the other. oh, there's no way to say it, because if you don't vote and then you begin to have certain seats that are just narrow win, like by 30 seats, 50 seats,
mm-hmm.
that really shows that every vote counts. So people need to first have that sort of shift in the mindset whereby they think that, oh, my vote doesn't count, but in fact, every single vote counts. And I actually was pondering on this. Would it help if Malaysia actually make it compulsory for all Malaysians to vote, you know? But obviously, you have certain group of people that maybe they won't want to vote.
You know, Singapore, just before we went there, they have the election for president. Then Australia, these two are the nation we know compulsory voting. But what are the consequences if you don't vote?
Well, I've seen one Australians that have not been going back to Australia.
Why?
I mean, obviously, he's settled down here already.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, seriously, if you don't vote, are they going to put you in jail? I don't think so.
But they are afraid, though, that there might be certain form of repercussion, because if they were trying to go back to Australia, maybe they might be blocked by the immigration.
Bar from coming back.
Yeah, maybe. I mean,
or bar from leaving.
Yeah, I think the concern is real for this person. Mm. But I'm just thinking, I mean, would it help? Maybe people need to be put under some sort of disciplinary action when they don't vote. But obviously, I don't prefer that, because that would be like going against my free will to vote or not to vote. But then again, I think maybe one of the things is really the government can begin to introduce like civic education.
Yeah, we should. I mean, the one point I want to say is that we have been so used to the right not to vote or spoil the vote, you know, and whatever. And yeah, in the end, I don't think that's the solution, but there are other ways to encourage. And I think going back to your point, start with local election, and I think it will just reignite the whole passion. Suddenly, you know, I have a say, you know, who is in charge of my area. It's more tangible, it's more localized, and I would say it's more personal, you know, and because not everyone is interested in GDP and things like that. And half the time, you know, when someone like Rafizi is speaking, they just kind of tune off, you know. It's like, he just said, oh, we're going to have some major change to the next Malaysian plan. It's like, yeah, yada, yada, so what? So that's the feeling I get from normal people. Only junkies like us are interested in the nitty-gritty detail. So, but anyway, let's hope in this cycle, are we going to see local election? I mean, if nothing else is achieved, but just local election in this cycle, I think it is still I think it will show a pass in Anwar Ibrahim's report card.
Yes.
Overall, even if he just achieved one thing, he still have 4 years to go.
No, one major thing.
Yeah. All right. So I think that's all we have for today. And I you know, maybe you find our take on Zahid Hamidi a bit different. But if you have any comments and you'd like us to elaborate more on some of the issues concerning DNAA, or whatever, you know, I'm not really an expert in this area, but we'll be more than happy to discuss more.
Yep.
But just when we think, hey, it's getting boring, and then all the hoo-ha starts again, right, in Malaysia.
Yes.
All right, but I think the next episode, you know, we are in this cycle, 31st of August to 16th of September. Maybe we talk a little bit about the meaning of Malaysia Day again, right? I mean, like, I remember
let's bring back the song.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Anyway, I think that's all the time we have for today.
Yep.
All right, so see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.